get to finish off your explorations in cosmology for you. And the basic plan for the rest of, I guess it's basically today, 2 hours, and then next week, first is to finish the discussion that Andrew started with you yesterday, which was sort of a general inflation discussion about properties of the solution for the background that we're looking for. And then what we'll spend most of our time doing is actually the calculation that people find sort of to be the current evidence that we have that inflation is the right story. Now you can be the judge at the end how strongly you want to take that evidence, but this is a bit of a long calculation, and it's just calculating the amplitude of fluctuations expected from inflation, which are actually the things that we observe, and that's where all the interesting information is in terms of the fluctuations in the CNB and fluctuations actually in large-scale structure in the density field that we see today. So this is where all the real sort of good observational power of the theory is. And the power spectrum is really a two-point function, the amplitude of fluctuations, and that's the thing that has been, you know, this sort of phenomenal success of observational cosmology in the sense that we've actually measured it very, very precisely. But it's really only the beginning of what we could do because it's really only sort of a first-order statistic from inflation. And the interest these days is calculating things beyond the power spectrum, because here you get a lot more significant observational handle on inflation and potentially also a more significant theoretical test. So hopefully if we get to it, we'll talk a little bit about what sort of the frontier theoretically and observationally, and most of that goes by the name of non-Gaussianity. Okay? All right, so let's finish off the story that Andrew was telling you, which had to do with sort of properties that we're looking for in the background solution, which is the evolution of h of phi, the Hubble parameter, as a function of time during inflation. Okay? So let's just put on the board quickly the results that you got to at the end of last time. So basically, you'd found that there were two small parameters that helped you define when your solution was a good solution for inflation, right? And these were go by the name of slow roll parameters. And the first one you defined was called epsilon, and this guy was related to the first derivative of the potential measured in Planck units. So V prime, primes are always going to be derivatives with respect to the field, phi, the scalar field, this thing squared. And you found that this thing being less than 1 is the condition for inflation. All right. And the second slow roll parameter is called eta. And this is defined in terms of the second derivative of the potential.
So is this less than 1 or much less than 1?
So if it's, so basically we're going to see in a minute that if it's at all less than 1 in a slightly different definition, that's the condition for accelerated expansion. Now, you know, the closer it is, the smaller it is, sort of the closer you are to this exact De Sitter solution, which is exponential expansion, which is sort of maximally inflating. Yeah. So I'm going to leave it as that for now, but we'll see, that'll clarify in a minute. Yeah, thanks. And this eta parameter being less than 1, and here to some extent, things as we'll see are a little bit more wishy-washy of what this means, so I'm going to put a slight, much, much less than. We'll see again in a minute what I mean. This is the condition, in some sense, for sufficient inflation. And as Andrew mentioned last time, one of the ways you can think about this is that the term in the potential, if you think about the simplest scalar field, so it has just a quadratic interaction, just a mass term, and that mass term, and you can sort of redefine the effective mass also if you include higher order terms, that thing should be much, much less than the Hubble parameter squared. Okay? And that's a tricky condition.
So what is this? Which potential is that for?
So if you just put in a quadratic potential, then it's literally the mass term. Now the issue, as you guys talked about a little bit at the end, is that you can also think of this as an effective mass, just really the second derivative of the potential, right? The effective mass once you add all the other terms into the potential, so any higher order interactions. And that's where the whole thing becomes sort of more interesting. Okay. Probably that's as low as I should go, yeah. Okay. So let's say just a little bit more precisely what we mean by sufficient inflation. And this is going to define one of the sort of jargony terms that you hear all the time for inflation. So usually people sufficient. Can I even spell? I don't know. Let's just say enough. That's easier to spell. Enough inflation. People usually write as enough e-fold. Did anybody define that term before? I'm not sure. E-fold is usually we have in mind that things are exponentially expanding. And you know, if you say something increases twofold or threefold times, you have in the sense that it increases by a factor of two, factor of three. So when we have in mind that things are exponentially expanding more or less, we call it e-fold. So this is this NE parameter that people go around quoting. And the way we define that, so of course if things are literally exponential, then it's a very simple definition because it's literally the ratio, right? How many times different it is at the beginning than at the end, so just the log of the scale factor. But in general, it might not be exactly exponential. And so we can define it as sort of the integral of the derivative of that quantity, d log a, so a is the scale factor, right? And this is the integral dA over a. And we want to put this in terms of parameters that we usually compute with, so let's put it in terms of h, for example. It's also the integral of h dt, right? Because this is basically dA dt over a, sorry. No, just h dt, right? This is a dot over a. And so often what you have is a solution for h of phi, for example. Often we don't even use cosmological time ever. We have h of phi. You can just use the scalar field and its position on the potential as a clock. So we can rewrite this in terms of just h of phi d phi. So what's that going to look like? That's going to be the integral of h over phi dot d phi. This is d phi dt, right? Okay. Yeah?
If you do that here, assuming that the scalar field is, in some sense, monotonic.
That's right. That's right.
And only that it's never stuck.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
It's always moving.
That's right. So in this sense, we always have in mind this picture that what we're looking at is the classical motion of the field on some, you know, slowly rolling potential. So the classical motion here until the end of inflation. Yeah. So this is always so it's going to be important that we have the background solution and we have the fluctuations on top, and the background solution needs to be monotonic. Okay. H over phi dot d phi. And then we can rewrite this again by substituting in the equation of motion for phi dot, right? So this is right now in terms of, for example, phi, let's say phi start to phi end. But we can also rewrite this as h. And what did we have for phi dot? Well, if we're in the slow roll regime, right, where we drop the second derivative term, and that was part of the condition for this eta parameter to be small, then we have that the equation of motion is just 3h phi dot is essentially minus v prime of phi. So we can substitute in here for phi dot. We're going to get a minus sign. We're going to get a v prime. And this is going to become 3h squared d phi. And we can write that in a little more interesting form by noticing that 3h is, of course, just v over m Planck squared. And now you can see that this is sort of the slow roll parameter epsilon sitting in here. Right? It's a root epsilon, basically. So this is minus, there's an extra m Planck. Let's pull it out because it's constant. And this is basically 1 over, I think, root 2 epsilon, right? To get the factor of 2, right? Okay, you can do more manipulations, whatever. But essentially, the number of e-folds is sort of an integral over epsilon. And we'll see in a simple case that that's going to actually be something like 1 over the second parameter eta. Right? You can see roughly here, and we'll do an example. Yeah.
The second last line, how did you get to that one?
This one?
The one above you got by using that equation.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Then I'm using again the first Friedman equation or the first Einstein equation. Yeah, thank you. Please. Especially, I know it's hard for you guys because you've had a zillion different teachers, right? It's also hard for me then because I didn't necessarily see everything that people told you. So please just let me know if I'm saying something that's not clear. So what I use there is just this equation. Okay. So it's very useful in this game to have a few examples that you do and that you keep in mind. So I'm going to do one particularly common example that people talk about all the time, and you're going to do another related example in the tutorial, I think. And this is sort of one of the simplest things that you can do, but it illustrates a lot of the features that are going to be important. And that's essentially to suppose that the potential is just some polynomial. Okay, so it's something maybe beyond m squared, but whatever. So let's just give it some coupling constant. Let's consider it phi to the n, and often people normalize with a factor of n factorial. Okay, so if this is phi 4, lambda is dimensionless. If it's something phi else, you know, you have to adjust the dimensions. So I'm not saying anything very specific about lambda or even the sign. Let's just assume it's just that. Okay, so let's work out a few important features. Certainly, we can work out what epsilon and eta are, right? It's easy to write down what the derivatives of this thing are. First derivative is just n lambda minus 1 factorial. Second derivative is clearly just n minus 1 lambda phi n minus 2 over n factorial. And so you can see that epsilon is Planck squared, there's a 2. We want to take this v prime, divide out by that, so that I get sort of everything except the extra n and one of the phi's, right? So we're going to have essentially n over phi quantity squared. And we can also write down eta, which is just going to be m Planck squared. And then this guy, again, divided out by this guy. So again, everything cancels except the n minus 1, and 2 powers of phi, right? N minus 1 over phi squared. Okay. So the first thing we might ask is, supposing that there's nothing else going on in this model, right? It's just really this one field rolling down its potential, where does inflation end? So often we have in mind that, I don't know how much you talked about this, but I think Latham mentioned it a little bit, that after this period of inflation, which is a slow, flat potential, something drastic has to happen so that we get the hot universe that we see. So this field essentially could fall off a cliff, inflation ends, it's going to wash around, and it's going to transfer its energy to the normal standard model fields that we see, so we get sort of this hot Big Bang, hot beginning to our universe. But the point is, if we don't do anything, you know, anything different here to say when this thing ends, then it certainly ends. Inflation ends when epsilon equals 1, right? We said epsilon less than 1 was conditioned for inflation, so let's just take epsilon equals 1 as the simplest end to inflation. So where does that happen? Well, you can see that happens at a value of the field equal to all this other stuff, right? So phi squared is, this is some integer number bigger than 1, so phi squared is some number basically of order or greater than n Planck squared. And because of that, because this field is so big, essentially, so there's even another sense in which it's going to be true, which is going to be when we talk about the field range. So it turns out that delta phi, the field range from beginning to end, and you can work this out, is also going to be, in many cases, you'll see an example on this on the homework, is also in many cases bigger than a Planckian distance. So these models are called large field. And this is the field range that this is would be basically phi start minus phi end. So we'll see that in just a second, actually. So these are called large field models. And there's a lot of curious things about these models, because when you have the field value so large, order Planck, if you think you have corrections to your potential that, for whatever reason, aren't suppressed by symmetries or anything like that, then it's very hard to understand how these models can actually exist, because you're naturally going to have terms in the potential, you know, even if the corrections to your potential are suppressed. So suppose you had whatever your original potential was, and then you added some new operator that could be there for whatever reason. If phi is order in Planck, these corrections are going to be large. So it's especially important in these models to have some prescription, some symmetry, as Andrew talked about before, that restrict the terms that can actually appear here, because generically they're going to be too big and they're going to spoil your potential. Okay, so let's check then this condition on delta phi. How are we going to figure out what delta phi is? So where inflation ends is easy, right? where inflation begins, how do we know what that is? Essentially, that's this condition about sufficient inflation, right? We have to make sure we get enough of it. So let's figure that out. Let me leave that expression. Let me rewrite that expression.
So when you say sufficient inflation, do we mean sufficient to solve the horizon problem and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So did you work out an example last time of how much that is?
Over 60.
60, yeah.
Well, Andrew told us that.
Okay. Let me plug into this equation so we get number of e-folds in terms of phi, and then I'll give you a quick way to see why it's roughly 60. Okay.
Is it not obvious from that expression that it's 60?
Yeah, not at all. And in fact, it has basically nothing to do with this expression in some ways. It has to do with the observations that we see post-inflation, right? Yeah, so yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so let's evaluate any for this case that we have, and then we'll figure out what that value has to be, and then we can get phi start. So what did we say? We said NE is this equation, 1 over m Planck, 1 over root 2 epsilon, d phi. And 1 over root 2 epsilon is just going to be what? It's just going to be phi in Planck units, right? Phi over m Planck, essentially. So minus m Planck. Did I forget? No, the twos cancel. Okay, so this becomes m Planck squared. And then we just have essentially phi d phi, and there's some factors of n. So let's not worry about factors of order one. Okay, so clearly this is going to, the number of e-folds is just something like phi start squared minus phi end squared over n phi squared. So the convention with the sign actually is that people take e-folds to be counted from the end of inflation. So you start at phi end, you say, how many e-folds did I have, and you sort of count backwards. So visually, you know, if this is phi end, people say, you know, one e-fold back, two e-folds back, three, four, five, to get to here, phi start, and that should be 60 e-folds. Because, in fact, the only thing we actually know if inflation is right is that inflation ended, right? There are reasons that you can think it had to also start, but it didn't have to start where we observe it. This cutoff is essentially an observational cutoff, right? That's the inflation we have to explain what we see, but that doesn't at all mean that it couldn't have lasted longer, okay? So sometimes people say, in my model, there are 100 or there are 1,000 e-folds of inflation. That's telling you just how different it is from sort of the minimal condition here. Okay, so let's say now we know that we want... Yeah.
It's kind of off the topic, so it's
okay.
Short answer maybe. Is it necessary to have a Big Bang singularity before the inflation?
Well, we hope not, right? Because then that's confusing. So I guess the issue is, so there's a very important question here, which is how do you keep running this whole thing back, right? And how does the whole picture make sense if you go back? So certainly, if you don't do anything and you leave inflation as it stands, you still have a singularity and you don't avoid the singularity problem. So you have to do something else to explain why that singularity isn't there. Okay, so why do we say n equals 60? So basically, this condition of sufficient inflation basically means we want to try to solve horizon and flatness problems. And Andrew drew this picture for you on the board yesterday. Hi, guys. We didn't erase too much, so it shouldn't be too far away. He drew this picture for you yesterday. Which was a plot of scale factor A as sort of a time. And essentially what we write today is A0, and we normalize it so that A0 equals 1. So we imagine A is decreasing in the past. And he drew you this picture of the co-moving Hubble radius. So this thing is 1 over ah. And this is the universe that we observe. So to draw this line precisely right, you have some very long period where it's radiation dominated. You have a short period of matter domination and an even shorter period of dark energy domination. So this is co-moving scales here. And what you need in inflation, right, if you imagine that this is some constant co-moving scale, what you need in inflation to sort of, if you want to come up with some, you know, causal explanation for why things look the same on large scales instead of just postulating initial conditions, and basically you need to run this co-moving Hubble radius the other way so that stuff that was outside the horizon was actually inside at some point and sort of causally connected, right? So you can see right away on this diagram that since what we observe is this part, and we sort of have some idea of which scales, you know, the largest scales that we see today came back in, then we have to have enough inflation to explain why the largest scale was actually inside the horizon earlier. Okay, so we can do an estimate to see how much inflation we need based on sort of a simplified picture of this and a simplified picture of that. Okay. So the simplified thing that we're going to do is we're going to assume, so actually most of this period written in terms of A is radiation dominated. So you can go back and you can fix this up, but we're going to assume essentially that we're just going to take a radiation dominated line here, and we're going to get pretty close to the answer.
Part of the curve with the negative slope is the inflation.
Yeah. Let's put this. This is observed. It's part of the inflation. And I don't even know where to put this axis, like we said, because we don't know where inflation started.
That means that, you know, the universe expanded so rapidly that the co-moving scales couldn't keep up.
So actually, in this case, remember the small fluctuations are being stretched out of the horizon. Okay. So let's get an approximate answer. Approximately how many? So for you guys that just came in, basically what we were doing was a simple example of an inflationary potential. And we said that the end of inflation was fixed by the condition epsilon equal 1, because yesterday you derived that epsilon less than 1 is a condition for inflation. And we were figuring out, you know, what the rest of the properties of the solution are. We want to know how many e-folds, and e-fold is just how many exponential fold times, two-fold, three-fold, exponential fold times the volume increased, essentially. And to calculate how many e-folds, we want to know, you know, you heard a number yesterday, 60, but roughly where does that number come from? Okay. Okay, so to get an approximate answer, let's assume or pretend, we know it's not true, but let's pretend for a second that everything since inflation was radiation dominated. And that's because it just makes a really easy power law of how A goes, right? So if that's true, then H, so remember H squared goes like the energy density. Energy density in radiation falls off like A to the 4. So H is going to go like A to the minus 2. Okay? So we can make a ratio comparing what we observe today to what we think happened at the end of inflation to get some idea of how total H had to change. Okay? So if H goes like A to the minus 2, let's see, what are we going to have? Then if we want to write, let's write H naught for H today. So H naught, the ratio of H naught over H E. So this is, E is going to be for N of inflation. Then this ratio should go like the inverse, right? So A N squared A naught squared. So in other words, we can say that A naught, H naught, so this is the co-moving scale now, right? So in some sense, that's the easiest guy to work with. A naught, H naught over A end, H end is the ratio, one factor left, A end, A naught. Okay, how are we going to get A end, A naught? So this is what we're after, sort of. Well, the thing that scales like A is the temperature. Right, temperature energy scales like 1 power of A, or 1 over A, sorry, right, dilutes like A. So we can take this to actually be the ratio of T today over T at the end of inflation. T today we know because that's what we measure, right, in the CMB. So in terms of EV, so it's something like 3 Kelvin. So order of magnitude, this is something like 10 to the minus 4 EV. T-end is also something that's uncertain, right? We actually don't know what energy scale the universe reheated at. We know it had to be above a certain energy scale, but we don't know exactly what it was. But if we take the scale that's going to come out of these models, so the simplest thing I can write down, m squared phi squared inflation, that should be something like a good bet for what inflation might be. So let's take that, and that scale, does anybody remember? Have you heard before? It's sort of like gut scale, essentially. So this is 10 to the 15 GeV, which is 10 to the 15, 10 to the 9 EV, right? So this ratio is 10 to the minus 28.
So why are we assuming that that's a gut scale?
So basically, what I'm doing here is I'm cheating a little bit because I know that if I was to take this model of inflation, the one we just did with, let's say it's m squared phi squared, and I take the energy at the end of inflation, so I take h squared and Planck squared is equal to v. Yeah, let me write it, sorry. Yeah, so where am I getting this? So basically what I'm assuming is I know that in the Einstein equation that h is related to v this way. Let's assume this is m squared phi squared. The constraint on this model, the thing I don't know is m, essentially. So it turns out by the calculation that we're going to do for the rest of the week, essentially, this thing is fixed by measuring fluctuations. And we already saw that phi is something of order m Planck. So if I assume that, if I take this constraint from data, which we haven't figured out how to get yet, and I assume that all of the energy that was inflation went into reheating the universe, then I get a temperature that's of order gut scale. So to actually see why I'm doing this, we're going to have to wait till the middle of next week. But so you often hear people say, and that's the motivation, that inflation is something like gut scale, because when people were writing the simplest models down, that was a very natural scale that came out anyway for what they thought. Physics should go at least up to the gut scale and everything unifies and all that. So that's where I'm getting to this number. And that gives us 10 to the 28. So what we're going to see is because the number of e-folds is really the log of this, you can change this reheat scale by quite a lot, and it's going to shift the number of e-folds, but it's going to shift it by some order 10 number. So often when people, if you want to do this precisely, the two things you need to do better are first work out what this actually is, right, because I assumed radiation domination, and second, people typically write the answer plus a scale of the reheat temperature, usually compared to GeV, so that whatever you think is your reheat temperature, you can correct it by that. Okay, so this is 10 to the 28. Now, basically what we need is enough inflation to get that ratio, right? And for inflation, let's see, where can I go? I can come back over here, maybe. Let me leave these. So inflation has to undo all of that, essentially. And inflation, we know that if we have h is essentially constant, right? So we have, and we have a going like e to the ht, and we said number of e-folds is, if it's exactly exponential, I can just directly take the log of this guy, right, and compare it essentially to the log of a at the end of inflation. So let's call this as for a start. Then you can see that what I need to do, since h is constant, take the ratio of the a's, right? So basically, if a start over a end has to undo all of that work, it has to be essentially the inverse of that, 10 to the 28, which I'm doing by just taking a end, h end, a naught, h naught, from this diagram. Then what I need to do to get NE is just take the log. NE is essentially log of 10 to the 28, and this is a number that's of order 60. It's 64 or something. Okay? So you can do a much more precise calculation to get exactly the number of e-folds, but roughly that's one way to see where 60 comes from. So just to finish off then, basically what we were doing is looking at this ratio, and we already knew that phi, what did we have? We had phi end was essentially M Planck times, essentially, so the potential we had was so when we took the ratio of this thing, it was essentially n times m Planck up to some factor of 2, I think. Okay. And now we know that from here, basically delta phi squared over m Planck squared is something like 64. So you can see that phi start is going to be some, you know, root of this times m Planck. Okay. So the upshot is, delta phi is of order m Planck. Phi initial is greater than phi end. Sorry, I was calling it phi start. Phi end is greater than m Planck. And these are, again, the large field models. Okay. Any questions about that? Good, that's great. Everybody should be asking questions. Thanks.
So you said that there's a, it's hard to justify why there are no corrections to that potential for the large field models.
Right.
Because if the delta phi is large, then if there are other terms, they should play a role. Is that the reason?
Yeah, exactly. So essentially, you expect, if you try to write down a simple potential, you try to write down. Yeah, suppose we had let's call it, you know, lambda whatever something plus dot dot dot. You can see basically that it's easier if I factorize out the corrections in terms of the initial potential energy, so that you can see that it's not the potential energy of this whole system that matters. So basically, if I have some quantum corrections here, I expect to get, you know, let me assume I have phi goes to minus phi symmetry, so it's always phi squared. I expect to get more corrections like that generically. This is the biggest scale that these guys can be suppressed by, right? The Planck scale. So here I'm assuming really there's nothing but gravity at work. So there's nothing extra fancy happening here. If phi is as big as M Planck, order one correction, right? So I have to have some reason to say, and usually it's often essentially this, most of this structure is missing. And that's where ideas, so for large field models, symmetries are important. And for example, you saw the shift symmetry, phi goes to phi plus c. If this is a nearly exact symmetry, right, then you can easily see why I shouldn't have these terms. And essentially, the cosine that Andrew showed you was a special example of that that people use. But this is really, you're going to see on the homework that people care a lot about these models also because they have a very important observational feature. Now, observational feature is that they have potentially observably large gravitational waves. So often people think that the presence of primordial gravitational waves is much more of an indication, much more evidence, much stronger evidence for inflation than just the scalar spectrum of fluctuations. But the problem is it's very hard to observe those gravitational waves because they're very suppressed, the amplitude. So there's been a big to-do about, you know, suppose we make a new satellite, the best satellite we can possibly make. We go to the CMB, we measure gravitational waves to the best precision we can do, you know, within the next 20 years. How well can we do? Turns out that you can only do so well, essentially, more or less, to still put you in the regime where you're measuring something from large field models. So then you say, well, do I believe that I have these symmetries acting so strongly to suppress these terms? Is that most models? Is that a subset of models? And of course, if you do see something, then you really are forced to figure out what's going on in terms of symmetries here. So on the homework, you'll work out exactly why that statement is true. Anyway, so there's a lot of interest in those. And I would say, so there's sort of two issues in inflation. One is figuring out, you know, what is the inflaton? What is the potential for the inflaton? What is even the classical physics? Well, classical in the sense of what's generating that potential that's relevant. And then there's a story about the fluctuations. So a lot of people's energy has been into, how do I make a good theory of inflation? Really just in terms of this. How do I satisfy epsilon, eta, its global parameters, and it's actually consistent, it's quantum mechanically consistent. Then there's a whole other, after you've answered that, and it's of course related in some sense, you have to say, now what's the prediction for the fluctuations? Right? Because the fluctuations are going to come by doing a Taylor expansion about a background here. So all of these same terms that you're trying to control for reasons like this are also going to contribute when you ask about terms at different order in the fluctuations, which we're going to do in a little while. So they're related questions, but in some sense they're. Some people try to ignore the issue of what's the background and just say, suppose we have a background that's given, let's parameterize fluctuations. But we really think that the theory, the full theory, we have to explain both simultaneously.
So could we not constrain these parameters from the fluctuation observations of fluctuations?
Yeah, so the issue that we're going to have, and so this is great because I just sort of in some sense told you that that's what I was doing here, right? But actually this is kind of a cheat. So people got very excited about this, but as we're going to see in a minute, when you measure this amplitude of fluctuations, actually that number contains very little information. And so it's true that if you have just one parameter over here, just one mass, just lambda phi 4, then that value of the parameter is fixed. But that doesn't tell you anything about whether it's reasonable that you had that model to begin with. And it's very hard to learn anything about terms that are smaller because we only see a small region of the inflationary potential and it's a small fluctuation. So actually it's very hard. So that's why a lot of the interest is actually in calculating things past the 2-point, which then are complementary information about those other terms and the potential. Okay. All right, so you're going to do a slightly different example on the homework just so you get comfortable. But the basic, you know, basic important things are, when did inflation end? When did it start? You know, is it super Planckian in some sense? And then the predictions for the fluctuations, which is what we're going to get to now. Okay. All right, so far, we've basically done two separate things, right? We've asked, when do we want for h of phi during inflation? And this was things like the slow roll parameters should be small. And what you spent most of the course so far doing was asking about how to describe fluctuations of a very simple system. So you usually did massless.
So what is H?
Hubble during inflation.
So
I'm always essentially assuming that phi is a function of time. Because, yeah, I'm always going to take phi to be the clock, essentially. So this is the evolution of h. So this is essentially Hubble of t. So you went to a lot of effort to figure out what is the spectrum of fluctuations of a massless scalar field in exact De Sitter space, which is h equal constant. So really, all the fun of this is to let the scalar field source inflation. Right, up until now, you never asked where this came from. It was some cosmological constant or whatever, right? It just was what it was, and you were done. Now we want to actually, because we want h to be sort of this dynamical thing, this time-changing thing, we're going to let the scalar field and that potential source that background evolution. And on top of that, we're going to ask about fluctuations and fluctuate. And this is going to give us the full spectrum of predictions from inflation. Okay. So let me take a moment and just remind you that this is the source, this calculation is the source of, we call it support, for inflation. So basically the fact that when we write down a potential that gives us the background properties of the inflationary period that we want, that almost for free in some sense, you know, for free if you go to a lot of work to do the calculation, you get a spectrum of fluctuations that can be matched to what we observe. Now, can be matched always means that you're choosing special values of these parameters, and as we already saw, this has to be sort of a special potential. So in some sense, you can do it, but the question is, do you think it's natural? Do you think it's fine-tuned? This kind of thing. So there's still a lot of questions that remain, but this success, this fluctuation calculation, is the thing that people are very excited about. And the reason it's so exciting is if you've seen the maps of the CMB, how much they've improved, right, over the past decade and a half. So the statistics have gotten very, very, very good, and that's why people are so excited about this. So the important thing is that the chain of events essentially is that what we're going to compute, what you've been computing, are fluctuations in a scalar field, delta phi. And what we're going to spend the rest of the time doing is essentially claiming that we can map those fluctuations into a parameter that's well-behaved outside the horizon, and that's a property of the gravitational potential. So we're going to get fluctuations in the gravitational field, the potential of the curvature. Usually people call this variable zeta. So we're going to map delta phi into zeta. And very loosely for the moment, you can think of zeta as being related to delta phi by h over phi dot. We're going to spend a lot of time working out why that's true, but let me just write it down for you for now. So this is gravitational potential or curvature. You have to be careful about the sign, but that's the meaning of that. And the point is that once you've done this post-inflation, right, then you do astrophysics. You do known GR, you do thermodynamics, you do all the good stuff that people have figured out how to do, and you can figure out what the signature is, for example, in the photon field, right? Once you have the gravitational potential, you can ask how do the photons see that potential, how does the dark matter see that potential, and you can figure out the resulting fluctuations in each of those fields. So you can figure out delta T over T. You can measure that with CMB. So this is the WMAP satellite, for example, which has been the important satellite so far. So this is where our current constraints come from, WMAP satellite. And in the sky right now is the Planck satellite, which is going to do even better. And then up to, so Planck is supposed to, this is 2013 probably, that we're actually going to get cosmological data from Planck. So then after that, up to this sort of fancy full satellite that people think might be able to measure gravitational waves, which, you know, isn't funded, isn't whatever, the CMB in some senses is almost done. So, you know, if we can get another satellite, we can do better in some respects, but this is it. So what do we do next? The next thing that we do is actually take the same calculation and see what inflation predicts for the spectrum of fluctuations in the matter field. So delta rho over rho density fluctuations in, for example, cold dark matter. And this is extremely compelling. So this gets measured by anything that's sort of surveying objects. So let me just say galaxy. Well, let's say structure. Surveys. Anything that's counting objects, asking what their mass, what their position is. And in some ways, this is more exciting because this takes the whole evolution of the universe in addition to the initial conditions and asks what the result is. And this is where there's an enormous amount of data that's going to come in. Yeah?
So we can measure the distribution of cold dark matter indirectly by looking at structure surveys.
Yeah, so I'm cheating, right? Because I'm saying cold dark matter, and of course what we see galaxies, we see bright things, right? So you have to think you understand how to map the position of those bright things to the position of the dark matter halo. Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting physics here, and this in a lot of ways is the future, because we know Planck is going to be fantastic, right? But we know what physics is going on here. We know how to calculate the CMB. And then we're going to be done. We're going to have the answer from Planck, and we're going to be done. Here we don't even know. We don't know what dark energy is. We don't know what the equation of state has to be. We don't know what dark matter is. You know, obviously, there are huge, interesting questions here. So in a lot of ways, this is the future of cosmology. But the point is, you know, from inflationary theory, what you have to do is get the statistics of this field, and then there's all the work to do this. But this is the output that we're looking for because we're trying to match to these things. Yeah, so we're going to see exactly what zeta is. It's a little bit tricky, but for now, let's say it's an admetric fluctuation. Okay. All right, so let me start with, you know, what is it that we're actually going to compute? That's all the windup. So the things that we measure are statistics of all of these fields. So we need to compute statistics of the initial inflatron fluctuations, or the curvature perturbations. So of course, statistics is the answer. So this is different, right? Up until now, a lot of this has looked like particle physics. But in particle physics, at this point, you're going to start calculating scattering amplitudes. You're going to ask what particles decay to what. How can we see it in the LHC? At this point, the only thing that we can do are actually calculate correlation functions of the fluctuations. And then ask, at different slices in time, what do we predict for the value of those correlation functions? Okay? But in principle, what we're after is the same sort of information. We really want to look for the terms in these Lagrangians. What are the interactions? Right? It's just that the interactions now get mapped to correlation functions instead of scattering amplitudes. Okay, statistics. Okay, well, the mean is easy. We're always going to look at fluctuations, so let's just skip that. So then, of course, the first thing we want to do are calculate the amplitude. Even zero. Number one is the amplitude. And in a little more fancy language, in Fourier space, this is actually the power spectrum. Okay, so it's the power in modes as a function of k. All right. So, so sort of to motivate where we're going with this and why it looks like something that you already calculated, let me imagine that what I'm really doing here, right, is I'm looking at, for example, points in the CMB. I'm correlating the temperature field at different points, or I'm correlating the density field at different points, right? So what cosmologists want to calculate is, let's say delta is delta rho over rho for dark matter. What we want to calculate is the expectation value for delta some point x, delta at some point y. Okay? So this is the real space. Correlation function. And of course, what we usually do is decompose both of these fields into Fourier modes, right? And look at what comes out. So if we had written the real space field at a point as an integral over the Fourier modes, let's just call it delta k. Then basically we can look at the expectation value of Fourier modes, right, inside of this integral. So this is going to be integral. It's going to be expectation value and integral of k1. And then another integral delta k2 at y. And so what you've been calculating essentially is versions of this thing, right? The Fourier space two-point function, or power spectrum, really. And you know what this has to be, basically. So there's always some 2 pi's in its definition. But essentially, because if you imagine looking at the CMB or at the spectrum of dark matter and taking two-point correlation functions, it shouldn't matter how I orient these points or where I put them on the sky, right? It should have isotropy and homogeneity. So because that orientation and position doesn't matter, the only thing that matters is the relative separation of those points. In a momentum space, essentially, that's saying the only thing that matters is the amplitude of the momentum, essentially a delta function of k1 plus k2. You also know dimensionally what this thing has to be. So delta is dimensionless in real space. So you can work out what its dimension is in Fourier space. And once you take into account the dimensionality of the delta function, you know it has to go like 1 over k cubed. And then there's everything else that's left, okay? So I'm going to make this a curly P, because often this whole thing here is called P of K, power spectrum. Okay. There's actually going to be some 2 pi's that we're going to work out in a minute. Okay. So the point is, heuristically, if you're a cosmologist, you know what form this has to take. You know it has to be something like this, and you know whatever is left over here should be roughly constant observationally. Maybe some slight. You can make some dimensionless running as a function of k. Okay, but that's what it has to be.
So that begins the Fourier capital.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so,
but in general,
so essentially it shouldn't matter what the overall direction is, right? So you can take this ansatz essentially, right? But it's a phenomenological or an observational. You know it has to look like this. You can take this guy and you can plug it in here and see what you get, and that's going to let you see it's literally the Fourier transform. So, and you're right again. Only the separation matters. So often this thing, it's really just a function. In cosmology, people often denote it C. It's a function of the separation between the points. And this is just some radial separation. So when you plug this in, if you want to get C of R, you see that the delta function is going to kill one of these momenta. We're going to have essentially only integral d3k pi cubed. We're going to have the 2 pi cubed killed the 2 pi cubed. We're left with essentially a 1 over k cubed. This thing I'm calling curly p of k and e to the I k dot r. Okay? So you can simplify this. Using spherical coordinates because only R matters. And you can align k hat, and align k in the z direction to make the integral easy. And when you do that, you're going to find that you can do the angular integrals. There's a k squared and a k cubed, so there's a dk over k. From the angular integrals, we got a factor of 4 pi, right? B was always a function of k only. And this guy, you can write, once you do those integrals, as sine kr over kr. Now it's all just magnitudes. And you can look at the limit as those 2 points approach each other. So now we're going to basically ask for the coincidence limit of this thing. So as r goes to 0, this is just dk over k. What do we have left? We've got a 2 pi squared pk. And this thing, this extra 2 pi squared, people often lump together, right? Because it's very natural when you define this. If it only depends on the scale, the 2 pi squared is always there. So people define this thing usually as a delta squared of k. The 2 pi goes in there. 2 pi squared goes in there. And that's really the dimensionless power spectrum in some sense. So then the dimensionless power spectrum, we'll finish this and then we'll take a break soon. So the dimensionless if you're an observer, you just want to write down a version of this equation that closely matches what you see, right? Forget about inflation, blah, blah, blah. It turns out that it's very convenient for inflation, too, but just forgetting about all that, this thing, delta squared, often people put here a subscript for whatever variable they're measuring it in, but it's generic. For the things that we want to compute, essentially has some amplitude. Let's put a zeta because that's going to be our variable. Has some amplitude, and there might be some scale dependence left over. Okay, so this is amplitude, this, because you want this thing to be dimensionless, there's some sort of, you know, theoretically meaningless, but sort of observationally relevant, because you need to put it at a good point that's within your observation, some pivot point. It just asks, where did you measure the amplitude at? And then there could be some leftover scale dependence after we took out the k to the 3. So this thing is called the spectral index. And the one here is sort of historical, right? So you might naturally just put for yourself some power there. But because sort of the most natural thing to come out of inflation is h, right? If we had exact a set of space, h would be exactly constant. You would have an exactly scale invariant spectrum, right? You talked about the massless field in de Sitter space as being scale invariant. So in some sense, the most natural thing to sit here should be zero. And so people sort of prioritize the deviation from scale dependence with this one, but you know, never mind. Anyway, it's historical. But that's the spectral index. So the point is that Wmap, for example, when we're really talking about the curvature fluctuations of inflation, and you can scale this so that it's the temperature fluctuation or the cold dark matter fluctuation, these things are very well measured. And the amplitude, well, let's see, this is really the amplitude squared, something like 10 to the minus 9. And this thing is something like 0.04 negative. So this, the fact that these numbers are small and precise are what people consider the success of inflation. So what we're going to learn to do then is to map this, you know, observational or phenomenological picture into a prediction for our theory and say, what are the quantities in the theory that give us a prediction for this and a prediction for this? And we've basically already written them down. They're going to be h over m Planck, they're going to be epsilon, they're going to be eta. Okay? Okay, does anybody want to ask any question about any of that? This form?
Yes.
It's completely phenomenological, yeah. So basically what people did originally is they looked at the sky and they said, well, things look more or less scale invariant. So this is probably just a constant. But it could be slightly scale invariant, and this is a convenient scale dependent, so that's kind of a convenient parameterization for slight.
If you give it a scalar field model, a particular model,
yeah,
you can calculate this delta squared.
Exactly.
And then compare that to that model to figure out what those parameters are.
Exactly, exactly. So basically, exactly, exactly. So the whole, let me just write that explicitly, maybe. At this level, which is the level where observations stood for the past few years, and to some extent where they still stand, then is the goal, you know, to match theory to observation is compute A naught minus minus one. So you can see that this is a bit simplistic, right? These are two numbers. And this one isn't even particularly exciting because what the CMB sees is actually, I erased my potential, but I think you're gonna calculate this also, but you know, we have this inflationary potential that has to last for 60 E folds. But the CMB, it sees large scales. At some point, the fluctuations get washed out on small scales. Essentially, the photons, you know, no longer carry an accurate record of that initial time. Instead, they get all washed around. Basically, the CMB just sees, you know, some few E folds, some maybe 10% sees this. So you can see that what people have been doing, in effect, is putting a point here for their potential, which the CMB sees, and almost sort of Taylor expanding about that point, right? Which, of course, you really want something that's flat for a really long distance, so a Taylor expansion isn't going to work. And that's the reason, part of the reason you had to, when we had that discussion about controlling all the parameters, that's actually an important issue that you don't see here, and that you don't see here, because, you know, this range of scales that the CMB sees is not a full range in K-space. And so you don't actually have a very long lever arm to see what this guy is. So there could be lots of things going on down here that you don't know. The only thing you know is that inflation has to persist. So people, huge industry has gone into calculating various values of VFI, assuming your inflaton is some field in supersymmetry or string theory, and then making these predictions. But these are two numbers, and so making those predictions is not maybe so very compelling, which is the reason that we eventually want to go beyond. Okay, maybe now's a good time to take a break, actually.
Yeah,
okay. So we'll take a break until...